Hello and welcome to episode 7 of Chips of Chorlton.
Don't look at me like that, mate.
I know, sorry.
You say seven.
Seven beautiful episodes of our podcast. We're back in my house for this episode, and I am joined by Andy.
Hi.
By Robin.
Hello.
Duncan.
Hello.
And we have a very special guest.
You're very special guest this time.
Very special guest.
Why are you looking at me?
Mike Joyce, thank you for joining us, Mike.
Oh, it's a pleasure now.
Really, really appreciate it. So is everyone all right?
Yeah, all good.
Yeah.
Loving your new kitchen.
Oh, thank you.
I really like the exposed brickwork. It's a bit like we're in Friends.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I don't know what I'd take that as.
Are you going for?
No, it wasn't. I suppose it's one of those things that it's just a thing to do is get exposed brickwork now.
This is
so shit for a music podcast, isn't it? So talk about how my exposed brickwork
goes. It's fine. I'm sure people can sense from the acoustics of this episode that your house is very burglable.
So I want to talk about the reshuffle at Six Music. I think that's kind of where I want to start off, particularly because you've done shows on there before, standing in for Riley, was it?
For Guy as well, and also Radcliffe and Maccone. I mean, I actually started at Oxford Road, which was back in the day, and of course that was for Mark, but also for Guy, when he went to Salford. And I had a great time there. It's always great. I mean, the great thing is, you know that the kind of listeners are kind of on a par with kind of my listening taste anyway. So it's not as though there's any kind of, cajoling really involved. It's always been a great experience.
Dutch Uncles, you've had a really good experience with Six Music as well, particularly on the last record. Certainly.
Our last record was by far probably the most successful one in terms of Six Music exposure, 3 playlisted singles, and obviously over the years we've kind of had guest appearances and sessions with nearly all the shows that I can think of. The only one we probably haven't is Keaveney.
Yeah, we even had Lamac, didn't we?
We even did have a Lamac. Yeah.
So they've changed the scheduling around at 6.
Chris Hawkins now gets an extra half hour. He goes from 5 till 7:30. You've got Lauren Laverne doing 7:30 till 10. That's the new breakfast slot, so 2.5 hours. Marianne Hobbs is now taking Laverne's slot, which I think is the most kind of interesting part of this whole puzzle, personally. And then after that, Keaveney then takes Radcliffe and Maccone's place at 1 till 4.
Yeah.
Lamac stays as he does. Riley stays as he does, and Radcliffe and Maccone will now move to Marianne Hobbs's breakfast weekend slot.
So the plan I've sort of read is to push Six Music to get more listeners, basically, to get 2 million listeners, and that's the idea behind it. Laverne's extremely popular, isn't she? That's the vibe. Is that going to impact the playlists that essentially you got on as a new and fresh band?
It has done in the past already. They've been, you were saying before, Andy, that they had actually been quite heavily criticised for having Foo Fighters and Muse on the playlist once it started getting announced that actually the station was really doing well, which kind of happened after there was threats of Six Music being taken over, becoming too extra or something like that.
Well, there's a fine line, isn't there? I think it's a station that doesn't playlist any other songs that other stations do, but there are a few bands that are on that line, like maybe the Foo Fighters and Muse and I suppose Elbow as well, in a sense. But I think it's probably a finer line than between any other station, though. But, I think they do it a lot less now as well. They're aware that their listenership, they want the station to be alternative, essentially.
Yeah, I don't hear new music. Yeah. Yeah.
I think the problem with playlists is, U2 are popular, right? Not with me, right? But that's a personal thing. Well, of course it is, but I think, when you're talking about the Killers, Muse, there's a lot of people that do like that music. Sometimes, if you want to be too esoteric, then I think you're starting to not rough your own back, but just because it's like sometimes a bit unheard of music. I know people that listen to Six Music, and they say, I was listening to it for half an hour and I didn't know any of the artists. It doesn't mean that they didn't like any of the artists, but that was the beauty, and that is the beauty of Six Music for me, is that regardless of whether you've heard the music or not, you're listening to what's being culled from the music industry by those individuals, by the producers sometimes, I think, but mainly by the individual DJs themselves, as being, you need to listen to this. This is something that you need to listen to. Whether it's, you know, even kind of, you know, opera, something as ridiculous as that. Yeah. So that's really important. But I think there's definitely, you know, when you have million selling artists, that just because you don't like them doesn't mean that that popularity isn't there. And I think, you know, we can kind of swing around. I mean, I've played tracks on radio by bands sometimes that I just thought, well, you know, this is, you know, pop music by M, you know, it's like... it's
War a tune.
It's a, well, there you go.
Excellent.
Thanks,
example.
Duncan.
Thanks excellent
for that,
example.
Mate. It's a great song. But, so, you know, and I've played certain songs and I thought, I'm not too sure whether people are going to like this or people are just going to go, no. Now, traditionally, in commercial radio, the fear factor of somebody switching off for that one song, that could mean thousands and thousands of people just switching off and thinking like, are they kidding? That's rubbish. And turning it off or going somewhere else. Now, commercial radio is a different animal, of course, because, of course, that's all based on listeners. Not because it means that we've got more listeners, it's great, we're popular. Listeners is what brings in the money.
Yeah.
The amount of listeners.
So do you see the difference at XS to Six in that respect at all? Is that,
yeah.
Yeah,
well,
definitely.
Well, of course, because... I think, what is it, 15 minutes in every hour at XS Manchester is ads. Because that's what actually pays for the station yeah. to be alive. And that's for every single station, every single radio station, apart from community stations in the UK, yeah. apart from the BBC. Yeah. They're in a very privileged position. And I don't just mean, you know, oh, license money. I'm not talking about that. And like, how much is he getting paid? That's ridiculous. And she should get paid as much as him. You know, I agree with that. But then again, that's not about, it's about just trying to be successful. Whereas with a commercial radio, it's about staying on the air.
Yeah, so I suppose it means that ad breaks in radio means that the radio station can conform to the identity that it wants to have as well. Like, it doesn't have to pander to the license payer or whatever. It doesn't have to feel like it's filling into a certain niche that the license payer needs to.
No, but it does have to pander to the people that the remit of the station is about.
Yeah.
Because, and also,
but
the
it can stay true to itself as well, I guess.
It can stay true to itself, but itself is kind of change. It can,
yeah.
Well, can't change, whereas with Six Music, it can, because it will be there.
Yeah. Well, you know,
BBC radio stations won't stop because the listeners have gone down.
But then they almost, well, it almost did though, didn't it? Six Music did almost... go under.
It feels like a different era that almost now.
Yeah, that was
though.
Probably 10 years ago, wasn't it?
I
can remember Riley and Guy Garvey campaigning about that sort of thing back in what year?
It was weird. I was doing work experience for my uni course, which we just talked about. in Mark Riley, though, and he was having discussions then, and I felt very privileged to sort of like hear the murmurings of what was going to happen.
He was like talking about his livelihood, like where's he going to buy his next pair of shoes, and you're just there kind of poking the ink demo at him, like, Mark, do you want to play this on tonight's
show? Oh, really? I was a radio plugger just for one band for one day. Yeah, listened for 20 seconds of it and was like, yeah, it's all right, this, I'll play it.
Yeah, it's like opened on it.
You did a great job. Like,
but that was because of the overall kind of auditors that came in to look at the way that the BBC was working, and of course
it was a numbers thing,
the Asian network was kind of under threat, and there was quite a few other aspects of how the station was being run in terms of where it was making money, where it was losing money. And I remember at the time, because I'd been working there at Oxford Road, and when people would say, you know, it's like, say Six Music, and they're like, What's Six Music?
Yeah.
And it became saved by the fact that it hadn't been heard before. It was the same station. It was playing the same music. It was playing the same, had the same kind of, except for not the same kind.
It was crazy. I remember when they were saying about getting rid of it, and at the same time, Radio 3, which had half the listenership at the time, was obviously safe because it's more of an institution. It's a BBC institution.
Yeah.
And I like Radio 3, but, you know, what why get rid of a station that has twice as many listeners just because it's newer?
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure the money that's pumped into Radio 3 is more, if not the same, as Radio 6.
I suppose from my point of view, the BBC's remit is to not allow those viewing figures to dictate what their output is, frankly. So
yeah.
I suppose that was the thing with Six Music. The reason why it was at risk is because... someone came in and said, well, they can get, Six Music listeners can get what they want from Radio 1. That was the whole problem with it, wasn't it? And obviously,
that's completely wrong.
Those are the kind of people that put on corporate gigs, and then you go there as the talent to do a corporate gig, and you realise that these people have never put on a fucking gig in their life. It's like, okay, and where's the rider? It's like, rider? You mean like, you know, like...
We thought you just spawned out of your nest.
Crisps, onto, dare I say it, chips.
Well, I suppose that's the difference between a listener and an auditor.
Yeah, it essentially is. Completely.
But I think we're right about the Six Music was saved, but it didn't change. And maybe it was just the sort of the triumph of the underdog, the alternative, you know, aspects of what the BBC does. People wanted to save, even if they'd never heard it before.
Well, I think it was more to do with the fact of, you know, with the tree falling in the forest, because it was a great station, but nobody knew it was there. You know, you can make the greatest record that you've ever made in your life, but if you don't get any radio play, nobody's going to hear it. Is it a great record? And I think that was the problem that Six Music had, is that they were putting out great music. It was kind of, it was more about the people. I felt as though the DJs that were actually involved in it, and this is what I wanted to bring to the station, is music that I thought people should hear, rather than the music that's being brought in by a PR company to the producers and to the DJs and say, here's the 15 tracks that we want you to play for this week. And it wasn't about that. It was more about, not an independent, in the true sense of the word, but independence of kind of playlist, in terms of, this is a great song, listen to it. I like this, do you like this? Have you heard this? Do you remember this? That kind of thing, rather than, because it's like a domino effect, because of course the record company releases the record, it gets a PR company, they go into the radio stations, and that was kind of traditionally how a lot of it worked. I mean, I've even heard of, well, I know that the Smiths, we never got on the A-list on Radio 1 ever, and we couldn't understand it. We were putting out what we thought were great records, and then of course we changed our plugger to somebody, I think it was a company called Ferret and Spanner, and it was, I don't know, tens of thousands of pounds, and all of a sudden we're on the A-list.
Of radio pluggers and all that.
If you don't play this, then you know that George Michael exclusive that you didn't that you wanted.
Yeah.
You know, you want this as well. So there's like it was not a close shot, but it was the way that it worked, and it probably still does now.
I mean, that culture wasn't. I imagine it's probably still quite prominent. I remember we sort of invested in that side of things, didn't we, in the early days?
Well, there's still weird practice from radio pluggers in general, I think. There was a radio plugger who we knew, and we had a story from another band who told us that essentially he met up with them in a pub. He's like, I really like your band, you know, let's do this. And then he said, it's going to cost this much, and this much. What do you want? And they probably said something like, you know, a reasonable Six Music play. And the guy walked them to a cash machine to draw money out, to get
£500 out.
Yeah, £500. If you give me £500 right now, then we'll get you a Laverne play.
But it was the case of every time you get a Mark Riley play, you give me £200. Every time I get you a daytime Six Music play, it'll be more. Yeah. And like it could mount up a bit. And I remember we had a similar situation, not in the same sense that we were taken to a cash machine, but we'd gone into an agreement with a company that took on some of our first singles when we first signed with Memphis Industries. And I remember there was definitely that point where obviously it was a bit of a honeymoon period. There was a lot of Radio 1 playing. It was like, oh my word, the system works. This is pretty decent. But then obviously, then for one reason or another, things will start to kind of, you realize the shape of what's going on, really. And then all of a sudden you're having these calls with people that are going, well, you got a Mark Riley play or two last week. You're happy with that? It's like,
yeah, that was me on work experience.
Yeah, it's like that was Andy on work experience who got that play. And also, we've all got him on our phone. It's like, that's not to say that Mark can be bought or anything like that, but I'm just saying that, like, kind of, you can't, you know, it's like you're talking about a friend of ours.
Andy, that example that you're given there, that's kind of third party skullduggery.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, whatever those kind of PR people are doing is kind of completely different from what goes on between the PR and the producer or the DJ.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yeah, because I was just about to say, yeah, I agree completely, because, you know, here's me saying, I'm sure it's not like that now. And I'm like, well, see, it's exactly the same as it was, just like I said. But I think in terms of those records, going back to what you're saying there, Neil, in terms of those records being played, the records that, you know, there's no such thing as a really big, successful, independent radio station. That will never happen. There's really big, successful stations that aren't independent, because the problem is, as soon as you become independent, then you're outside of the BBC. And then that means, again, bringing money in. I did it with a radio station called Beatwolf, very short-lived. And what I wanted to do was, in fact, they asked me to go down to the offices, and I thought they were going to offer me a job DJing. And they said, do you want to be the station manager? And I said, no. And they said, really? And
well,
I said,
why not?
Yeah, well, I kind of drove home and I was like, station manager, that's ridiculous. Because working at the Revolution in Oldham, the station manager is the guy in the corner having the breakdown with, you know, with a bottle of whiskey in his drawer going, like, yeah, I'm fine. Because he's having to deal with all the egos, he's having to deal with all the people there. And the only thing, it's a thankless task, because when it's working properly, nobody's like, oh, well done.
Yeah, it's on air.
We can hear it. We turn on the radio. Yeah. So he's having all these individuals, and it's a very difficult thing to do. Anyway, I came home and I spoke to Bea, and she said, you can't do that. And I said, no, I can't. It's ridiculous. And I thought, when's the next time I'm going to be offered to be a station manager? It's never going to happen. So I phoned them the next day and I said, oh, I'm going to take it. Let's see what happens. Wow. Yeah. 3 weeks later, bottle of whiskey in the corner. Yeah. And it was just unbelievable because, again, it was, and I started to realise, because I'd been working with East Village Radio in New York, and they were a victim of their own success, because as they became more and more successful, they had millions and millions of listeners. But they didn't have any sponsors because it was internet radio. And it wasn't, so all the kind of colloquial firms wouldn't advertise with them because it was being broadcast in Rio and New York. Yeah, so, yeah. Of course, who's going to advertise on that? You're not going to get Salford Van Hire advertising
on East Village Radio. Desperate in the US.
You never know.
So it just became kind of quite an incredibly difficult thing to do. And the reason why I wanted to bring presenters in, I didn't want people that were just going to be, yeah, this is great, I like that, and kind of bantering between the songs that were kind of not that interesting. I wanted the music to be the most important part. And whether, even if somebody came on that I couldn't understand what they were saying very well, I wasn't that bothered really. I wanted to hear them. I wanted to hear what they had to bring to the table for 2 hours in terms of their music. And there's a lot of dance acts that I brought in, dance acts, DJs specializing in dance music and indie and no rock, because I was the station manager. But there was quite a decent spread, I thought, of people that are just bringing interesting things. But of course, It was very haphazard, and it didn't really kind of have a focal point of, you know, Beatwolf Radio is this. Yeah. It was completely everywhere, and it folded because we found it very difficult in terms of getting people to come and pay for that. Whereas with the BBC, as we said before, it'll never fold. They can pretty much play what they want, and I know that there's. They don't just play what they want. I mean, they've chosen those presenters and to play records that do resonate with the listeners. Of course, I'm not saying somebody going like number nine at 4 in the afternoon isn't going to work.
So yeah. I want your funny stories. I think you've got some of Six Music, haven't you? Some sort of anecdotes.
Well, yeah, because Mike, you saw that I've got my phone out of my notes, and you're like, oh God, he's brought an essay, and it's like, you're right, I kind of have. But then I said to you, well, one of these points is actually just Pete telling Mark Riley to fuck off, and it's like, okay, well, how's that come about? And yeah,
it's our first like introduction to Six Music, though, really, wasn't it?
It kind of was.
Pete telling Mark Riley to fuck off.
Yeah, because the only time I'd really heard of Six Music before then was a field music session that I just found on YouTube that was a Riley session when they did the Tones of Town album, because I was just so into the album at the time and stuff. I don't know why I said that sarcastically. I still am into that album. It's a very good album. But I remember, you guys had all been out for New Year's Eve, hadn't you? Was it like Jabez Clegg?
Yeah,
done that thing?
Like
the classic Up the Racket versus Juicy. You'd all been doing that.
Yeah, I remember that.
I'd been doing a shift at Font Bar. It was all good.
Weatherspoon's Breakfast.
Weatherspoon's Breakfast, did you? Oh, very good.
And that's where we got the call.
Head of the curve there. Anyhow, so on New Year's Day, that more like, is it the morning or the afternoon?
Midday.
Okay. Somehow, some way, Mark Riley rings up Pete.
Yeah.
And he goes, "Hey, Pete, it's Mark Riley. Can I book you in for a session at Six Music?"
Well, Pete thought that it was a piss take.
Yeah,
like, he thought that it wasn't him at all. So he just went, "Mark Riley, fuck up, it's not you."
Yeah,
hung up.
Yeah. So Mark Riley calls him again.
I hope that at home Mark was went, "You know what? I love that. I'm gonna call him back."
Yeah. Punk spirit. Yeah. Rings him up again. "Hi, Pete. It's Mark Riley. Can I book you guys in for a session?" And then I think it happened again, didn't it? Happened a second time.
Whoever this is, will you just fuck off?
And what I want to know is how is it that when Mark Riley got a copy of our first album, it was Pete's number as the contact on that?
I have no idea.
How did that ever... I mean, no offence, Pete, but... Yeah, but anyhow, so yeah, that was...
The German record label gave him Pete's number.
That's so weird, isn't it?
Yeah,
I suppose talking of sessions, live sessions, the Laura Laverne one that we did on the Big Balloon Tour, was the most... We had a heavy few days that we won't discuss on the podcast at the minute, but it was a really good session, wasn't it? And live radio is so nerve-wracking. It's probably the most nervous... You know, doing the Riley thing for the first time for me was just like,
Yeah, that red light comes on. You're completely exposed to, you don't know how many people.
Yeah.
And yeah, but then also you're sat in the same room as Lauren Laverne. And she's just sat next to you, just staring at your play. It's like, this is quite bizarre,
it's the most showbiz moment you get as a guest, I think, on Six Music.
Peel. It's quite an infamous sort of Smith session. What was that like? Because I shat myself in front of Riley and Laverne. It's like fucking John Peel, and you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, shatting was par for the course, obviously, for everyone.
The classic session shat.
Yeah. It's shat time. Fader up. I think, you know, when you were saying before about that pinnacle of success, kind of what you're saying, but I think, you know, it's such a strange... not dilemma or dichotomy, I don't know, but you know, because when you're playing gigs, you're playing in front of an audience, a live audience, and then when you're in the studio, those are the two beasts, really. And when you're in the studio, it's like, well, you know that what's going down is going down forever, and you know that people are going to be listening to it in the future, but really, I mean, of course there's a different kind of pressure, but not that pressure of straight away performance and kind of straight away reciprocated kind of like it or love it or hate it even. But with the sessions, it's both.
Because
it's a live performance in a studio. What's going on here? Okay, that's not right. You know, it's like, now hold on a minute, my bass drum's squeaking. Now, oh shit, sorry. It just can't happen. So it has to be done. The Smiths did some of their best performances. In fact, there was an album that came out with the compilation of Hatful of Hollow with those performances on. Because I think always gives an indication of what the band's like. Because you can go on YouTube, you can see some gigs, or you can kind of have listened to the stuff and radio plays or CDs or whatever it is. Whereas sometimes... It might have taken them 8 months to do that verse. Never mind that song that album. Yeah, so the idea of you're in, and that's what you get, and that's the realism of it, and that's the proof of the pudding, really, of what you're capable of doing and what you. I remember we did a we seem to be. I mean, the Smiths, we burnt very brightly and for quite a relatively short period, but when we had those opportunities to do that. It worked very well. I think we were trying to impress each other, and I think there's probably a bit of that with you guys as well. You know,
I feel like with us, we're all just crapping ourselves, like, sort of individually. Yeah. It's a very separate experience, but we're all shitting ourselves.
But we can all tell how much we're shitting ourselves by the expression we're all kind of wearing at the time. So we all know how nervous each one is. So, but there's never anyone to really look out for.
But Mike, we were talking before about frontmen. Like, I crap myself at live sessions as a drummer. But I can't imagine what it's like to be a frontman. I mean, I know at least you don't have to do sort of a visual performance, but to try and get across the sort of charisma and lyrical content that you got through in the recording or when you first wrote the lyrics must be a lot different to my experience as a drummer, just basically playing the drums.
I think it's harder being the interviewee in between the songs, really. I remember after actually the first after the first, because we've done three Laverne sessions, haven't we?
Yeah.
And after the first one, I remember my girlfriend at the time texting me immediately after, going, "Are you okay?" I was like, "Yeah, I think I'm fine."
Really good motivation.
Did I not sound? Yeah, yeah, it's like, did
I wasn't
not,
until I got that text.
Yeah. I was like, I remember thinking, like, did I not sound fine? But obviously, it was quite early in the morning. It was that time that we thought we weren't going to make it as well.
Oh,
do you remember that? It was like a heat wave in London. We'd just played Hop Farm Festival the day before. We'd stayed like just outside of London. Somehow, some way, we were supposed to be there for 11 o'clock. Because you play at 12. And we didn't get there till about half 11, 20 to 12. Like, you got 20 minutes to get your gear through Wogan House, up four flights in the elevator, get set up, sound check, and then do two songs and actually be on it. And it's, and you realize it's your biggest sort of, well, it's your biggest live session. Because when you do Radio 1 and it's made avail, that's pre-recorded anyway. So if you don't like it, they will give you another chance.
Yeah.
But they won't give you too many, will they? So,
yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you talk about, it's like I'm reading a great book, Victor Cassis, I think his name is, about Andy Warhol at the moment. And I've started to kind of delve into a little bit of his psyche and his thing. And you can tell that because he didn't know the answers and because he didn't really know how to describe himself as an artist and what is an artist, and because these are the questions that were given to him, and one of them was, you know, how do you feel about certain people liking you and certain people hating you and things like that, and his answers were, I like horses. So, you know, and I think me and Andy would probably go down that route as drummers.
Yeah.
Because when in doubt, well, you know, kind of saying, you know, you can't understand, you know, how, what that must feel. Because that Askers were drummers. Because I feel the same thing when we were talking earlier and saying about, you know, I've seen Morrissey's performances, I've seen Duncan's performances, and you think, wow, how cool is that? But how? But it's weird as well, because I'm terrified of the front of a stage. I go to the front of the stage and it's like, why? What are you all looking at? Why are you looking? Everyone's looking at me. I'm turning away. I freak out. Can't handle it at all.
Yeah.
Whereas you're embracing that. That thing, that experience, because the people are just kind of not doing the thing. Then obviously you want that attention, you want that feedback, that immediate feedback. You want people to be kind of looking. I mean, one wants that immediate attention. One wants.
I say at this point, Mike is directing a lot of his.
Duncan's just
a lot of his
crying.
Body language. He's facing me.
You know what I mean, love. but as front people do, you know, because to kind of say how you feel and what the creation that you've made in word form, and then to sing it, wow. Well, I think that's kind of where I'm coming from, the Andy's perspective.
In all the 13 years we've been gigging, Andy, it still gets my goat. Well, it doesn't get my goat, but it always, like, it's always something I go, oh God, I've got to face, like, I've got to kind of match this. Whenever we're doing sound check in places, it's like, right, drum vocal first. You're always hilarious.
Well, I, you know, I try.
And Rob, you're suitably, well, you're, no, suitably yourself. You do your thing.
Yeah, but my voice is too low that no one can hear it anyway.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. And I'm the last one to say, and I'm the last one to check a microphone. And I'm just like, Andy's already told all the funny stuff. It's like, what am I supposed to do? Okay, me, my mo. Like, do re mi. I'm just like a
thing
lost
is at this point,
choir
we're really
boy
performing to fill our sound tech. You know,
I think that's, you know, he's our harshest critic.
Cricket. He's our harshest cricket as well.
But all I do is sing Through Glorious Food, and that always seems to get a laugh. You know, the hot sausage and mustard line.
I know, but then you get all the sound. But then you get all, like, the stage technicians and light technicians, like, ah, oh, that guy, he's set your watch by that kid. Who's this miserable cover the front?
Your head, don't.
Well, the thing, Andy's covering, like, the sibilance as well with the mustard.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So, and that's where the degree came
well,
in.
Well, exactly.
Mate.
$30,000 well spent, Mike. I'm glad you could appreciate it.
Well, I mean, when Morrissey'd walk on stage and it'd be like, okay, and you can try the mic and it'd go.
Did he ever sound check?
Yes.
He doesn't strike me as the kind of guy that would sound check. You know what I mean? After a while.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, he was there pretty much every. I mean, not every time, but I mean, he'd go on it, it'd be like, one, two, three, four, five. And I was like, good on you, man. You know, it's not going to be like, yeah,
give
right,
them
hey,
nothing.
Hey, my wife. Yeah. Funny thing happened to me on the way to the gig today. You know, I knew he'd just kind of, but just 1 to 10 and then back to 1 again. That'll do, man. Just, you know what I mean? Don't worry about it. When you start singing, the guy will get it. If you can't get it, then he's shit.
Mike, do you like sound checking a drum kit?
No.
I was about to say, you look really unimpressed. Yeah.
At what point in the Smiths' success did you have to stop line checking your own drums?
Never. Never, because I didn't dislike it that much. Because I wanted to go and have a play, and we'd hang and we'd write. Because I remember with the first major tour that we did for Meet His Murder, when that was released, all the gigs were sold out. I'm not bragging, I'm just saying. But they were, and it was, you know, the Albert Hall, and it was just huge tour. And then I said to Johnny a couple of weeks before rehearsals, and it was like, okay, right, that'll do, nice one. And I said, are we going to do, so, you know, maybe some production rehearsals, you know, for this tour? And he said, we've got the sound check. And I said, what do you mean? And it was like, well, the sound check, what, we're going to run through the set? And we didn't rehearse for the tour, you know, and we just kind of finished, not rehearsing for that tour, we just kind of finished rehearsing. I mean, a couple of weeks off, and it was like, are we going to, you know, do some rehearsing before we actually, you know, maybe, you know, not pre-production kind of thing.
Yeah, cue up the pyrotechnics.
Or a set list, at least. And he said, nah. He said, we've got the sound check, it'll be fine. Which frightened me a little bit, really. I think partly because of, I turned it as my kind of musical kind of I wasn't as proficient as Johnny and I wasn't as fucking good as them. So let's put it as in a basic context. Johnny and Morrissey, Johnny and Andy, fantastic musicians. And then there was me, and I just kind of felt as though it's like, wow, because they were playing stuff that I was a punk, you know, just from a punk band really. And of course Andy, you know from Neil Young and Crazy Horse and Nils Lofgren, and some real kind of players in there, and Stanley Clark, I mean, he was kind of slapping bass and stuff. And I'm like, what are you doing, you know? And I found that quite, I was like, you know, the more rehearsals that we can get in, the better. I would have said, you know, because I just wanted to feel comfortable with it. And he's like, oh, I'll be fine. I was like, yeah, but Johnny, you wrote it. You know it, it's fine. You know every little idiosyncrasy that it's got, and you're just going to stand up there and just play this, and you just want me to play along. Can't we just do some rehearsals? But we did very, very little rehearsals. In fact, I don't think we ever rehearsed for a tour.
Yeah. But I sort of feel the same in a way. Like, obviously, I knew I was going to compare Dutch Uncles and the Smiths at one point, but let's gloss over that. But I feel the same in a sense, like, Rob's, compositions, and they're very intricate. He knows them back to front, he knows where everyone should come in, come out, and, you know, what intricacies they need to play. But I feel like I'm more sort of the backbeat, but at the same time, need a crap load of rehearsals to feel confident to play along with complex music, because I'm not the most naturally gifted musician. But that's no bad thing in a way. I think that in a way it sort of makes our bands better in a way, because it's more simple.
Well, it's fundamental. Well, you talk about that kind of a lack of self-belief sometimes. I remember playing a gig in Hulsford Festival, and the drummer from Faith No More, I don't know his name, absolutely terrifying player. I was watching him at the side of the stage, and it was just a different league. Anyway, we were in having a bite to eat, and he came up to me and he was like, I saw your drummer, man, you know, great drummer. And he said, where did he go to school? And I was like, St. Greg's in Hardwick. Do you know it? And he's like, Hardwick? And I'm like, yeah, St. Greg's. Do you know it? And he's like, no, what, is it a good music college?
Is it classical? Classically trained?
No, it was a pretty bad school, actually. You know, we just used to get battered all the time. He's like, they used to hit you? And he was like, that's quite hardcore, you know, way of learning your instrument.
Experimental approach.
And I was like, no, I didn't go to college. I was just on my mum's couch, you know, with a pair of knitting needles. And he looked at me like I was mad. Because, of course, he just thought, well, you know, you must have learned at that music college, you know, when you go to music college to learn to play the drums. It was like, no, I didn't. You know, I learned to play the drums in a band. That's where I learned to play. So not many people, right, that listen to records that go, top drumming on that. Well,
isn't it? Like, sort of, like, virtuoso drummers. It's not, like, that appreciated, really, is it? And maybe for...
It's just a bit of a drum wank, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it's strange. It feels like the more indulgent sort of instrument, if you're really good and you're going for the big old drum solos, it's just not that easy to appreciate for people, I think. Whereas,
well,
you know,
it's a throwback. I haven't seen it happen since Under Mortal Orchestra did it at Liverpool I want to say Sound City.
Yeah,
is that what it was? I remember we were like, did we share a stage with them that time? I say we share a stage with them. There were like quite a few bands above us, but like, I remember like, you know, they had a very psychedelic show and it had an appropriate drum solo in it for a live show, but it still felt quite kind of, oh, they've thrown this in to kind of please the prog dads, yeah, as it were. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And they're like, I can't help but feel a bit that way.
It's an old school sort of pastiche thing now, I guess.
Well, I think you're doing yourself a bit of a discredit there, Andy, because I remember being a fan of Dutch Uncles before sort of playing with you. There were people used to come away and just go, that drum is superb.
You know, actually, I mean? The first time I saw you drum was a drum solo, I think. Really? That Battle of the Bands.
He's looking at Andy, not me. Let's just have that for the record.
Joyce, the only time I've had the pleasure with you is when we shared a stage, dear boy.
Hang on, that's
it. Yeah, Band on the Wall, of course, remember it.
The Jack Daniels set. Mm. I know, it's like...
It's an absolute dream team.
It is absolute dream team. It's absolutely crackers thinking back on that, actually. Like, my mum's still got the City Life cover framed up in her house. That was a good show, that, wasn't it?
I enjoyed it.
I was trying not to be sick. I'd had too much Jack Daniels and ginger beer at the time.
Well, it was because Jack Daniels put it on, isn't it?
Indeed. No, I mean, if you keep saying it, they might sponsor us at some point. the first time I saw you play drums, Andy, you were actually doing a solo at the Battle of the Bands. You opened the first song that Rodine did. I'm now pointing my finger at both of you here. This is when I was in a...
Terrible band.
I was in another band called Dutch Uncle, without the S. I remember thinking, my God, that boy's fantastic. I take back what I said about drum solos. Like, they can be all right.
Oh, that was shocking. I thought I was really, really good, and just did like about half an hour's worth of semi-quavers on various drums, and that was
just half an hour.
Yeah, I know.
Andy, please. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll side with Neil on this and kind of seeing, I'm a massive fan of Andy's playing, massive fan. And I've told everybody about it, so I'm not just saying it now because he's 4 feet away from me.
But I'm a big fan of
Andy's playing.
I think people who, I know probably some people who aren't musicians even appreciate it. I mean, they're probably the
Yeah, that's what I said. I really like Andy's playing.
I think people who go to Dutch Uncle's gig understand that it's not a simple drum beat that you're playing.
But I think it's still more about the sort of the sum of its parts, though. The beats exist, and I play them as part of Robin Dunk's creation, in a sense. Like, that is, it's just a part of it, and it's nothing ridiculous. It's not that even ridiculously hard to play. It just slots in because of the sort of complexity of the composition, I would say.
Well, I think it's also familiarity for me.
Yeah.
Because all the times I've been to see Dutch Uncles, you know, I want to see Dutch Uncles, and that's what I see each time. Yeah. And I'm comfortable with that. And, you know, whether it's some kind of, you know, knowing that Andy, knowing that you are there, kind of, because interpretation is a very kind of weird thing, isn't it? Because you give somebody else exactly the same parts to play, it won't sound the same. I went to see the Bunnymen at the Bridgewater Hall, and I mean, obviously Peter Freitas, I mean, that's some big shoes to fill, but I didn't really like it because the drummer that they had didn't really do it for me, and it kind of spoiled it, really.
Yeah.
Because I just needed to hear, I mean, I'd seen the Bunnymen post De Freitas, with other players, and I was perfectly happy with it. But this particular player that they had, he wasn't playing out of time, he wasn't playing wrong, it just didn't really do it for me.
Yeah.
The way that your style is, because I've had the same thing when people have said, oh, when you go to the Riding, some girls are bigger than others.
That is fucking great, though. You literally get the favourite bit of Smith's drumming.
Is that the most often referenced part?
No, once.
So good.
Once, why I did it?
About 15 years.
But do you know why I did? Because I was bored of playing the hi-hat. That's it. You know, it's just one of those things, you know, but it's just something that, you know, we kind of, again, our own kind of little idiosyncrasies that we have. And then somebody says to me, in fact, it was, it was Radiohead covered Headmaster Ritual, and it's on YouTube. And Tommy York was saying, you know, we've got the, you know, got Mike Joyce's drumming, is the kind of the Mike Joyce-isms absolutely down to a T. And I'm like, what are those? What? He drops a stick. What's he going to do? And it's quite interesting because, of course, I never see it like that. One doesn't. You just kind of think, well, that's what I do, and I do it, and I do it to the best of my ability. And certain kind of little things that are in there, and it's like, oh, that's like a Mike Joyce kind of fill. And, you know, and when you hear people kind of say those things, I'm like, oh, is it? Right, okay, well, I'll take that, you know, but...
I was going to say, you know, that there is the ride in Some Girls Bigger Than Others, but I would argue that the snare fill at the beginning of Headmaster Ritual is spicy.
Well, do you know, when we did that, when we recorded it, it was in Liverpool, I think, and we'd done all the tracks that we'd worked on, and then Stephen Street was like, right, have you got any more? And it was like, yeah, sure. And we hadn't. And anyway, kind of, he said, right, I'm just going to zero the desk. And we said, oh, we're just going to run through that the other songs that we've got. And Johnny said, I've got this riff. And he started playing that riff. So, I just kind of did that. And it was like, right, okay, that's it. And it was like, Stephen came, you know, on the talk back mic. And he said, well, how's it going? You ready? You know, have you brushed up on it? And he's like, yes, kind of. Yeah. And then we recorded it. And that was it. That's the take that's down there. Because I didn't know it. You know, we'd never played it before. And we just kind of knocked it out. And then when Morrissey did the vocals, the da 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 da, yeah. It's, of course, it's with the da 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 da. So all that kind of came into place. Now, if I'd been working on that for, you know, 6 months, or I was a kind of technical player where it might not have happened.
Yeah, and we might have overthought it.
Absolutely, and, yeah. Overplayed it and just kind of, and naturally kind of gone, you know, I don't know.
Got some hi-hat in there.
If I had the capability to kind of broaden outside of what I was capable of doing, it would have sounded very different. It's like the intro to Reel Around the Fountain. Boom, cat, boom, boom, cat, boom, boom, cat, car, boom, cat, boom, boom. That's it. But, you know, people would say, oh, I love that intro. Well, I reckon if it was, you know, if I was kind of Mr. Shaw for it, dum, sat, dum, dum, sat, dum, 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 they would have turned around and gone, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah.
You weirdo. So sometimes that kind of inability can be, you know, use your faults, use your defects as your strengths.
But don't realise you're doing it at the same time, though.
No.
Because otherwise they won't be.
No, absolutely.